This is a Siva podcast.
Yes, it's a big pleasure to have Beatrice Colomina with us on the occasion of a new exhibition at Siva called Sick Architecture. And it's a very unusual exhibition, which happens in collaboration with Princeton University and Eflux Architecture. And maybe starting with the title, Beatrice, what is Sick Architecture?
So Sick Architecture, well, the exhibition really offers a kind of kaleidoscope of both sicknesses and architecture, and the intimacy of the relationship between both of them. So basically the exhibition is much more about raising questions than about prescribing particular design solutions or even prescribing particular strategies or environments for health.
Yeah, in a way, there seems to be an obvious approach to this topic on the relation between architecture and health, which is hospitals and psychiatries. So classic Foucauldian examples, one could say, where architecture somehow gave form to institutions that were more or less invented or started by doctors. But what's, I think, very specific to what we were trying to develop is this myriad of incredibly diverse examples where maybe something becomes very obvious that for you, architecture is a very expanded notion of design. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could give some examples of how this manifests in this exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in many ways the exhibition is about opening actually the field of architecture and raising new issues and new questions. So you expand the field of what architecture is, but also what sickness is. So from this very simple understanding of hospitals and hospital architecture to really unexpected issues. In that sense, it's a research show, because of course there are artists and architects involved in the exhibition, but at the core of it, it's a group of young, if you want, avant-garde scholars that I think represent the future of architectural thinking. And in this team of people, they have raised questions about age and architecture, which, for example, is normally not thought about it, but also even more unexpected things like menstruation or birth control or, you know, disabilities, or so many other aspects of architecture that is involved with sickness, like toxicity of materials, but also toxic masculinities. I mean, all kinds of unexpected issues that are raised in the exhibition. Post-industrial psychiatry, hunger, colonial medicine, autoimmune diseases, the medicalization of the borders that has become so clear to us now with COVID, that we all have to pass the borders of countries with our vaccines, etc. But if you go back historically, Ellis Island was always about medical control. Angel Island, all the borders of countries have been always, so there's been this medicalization of the border historically. But they are expanding the understanding of architecture, because architecture is not simply buildings anymore, but expands to the territory, to borders, etc. Right? So we expand our understanding. You come out of the exhibition with an expanded understanding of what architecture is and what sickness is. And this is the interesting thing. Sickness turns out to be normal, and architecture maybe is pathological.
Yeah. Talking about architecture and the role of architecture, there is also in our thought and in our concept, we of course also realize that very often the architect is somehow the doctor, mm-hmm, or the shrink, yes, of, of a client. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's also interesting to talk a bit about this, like what is the role of the architect in all of this?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because even historically, from the very beginning of architectural theory, Vitruvius already argues that the architects should also study medicine, because the most important goal of the architect is health, right? And so you see this constantly throughout history, this idea of the architect as a doctor trying to prevent all kinds of diseases, like Le Corbusier's obsession with tuberculosis. So normally it's the disease that is dominant at that time. But as some of these medical conditions start to be controlled through medication, like streptomycin, for example, the same architects, and without changing that much of their architecture, start arguing that their architecture is good for mental health. So Neutra, for example, obsessed with tuberculosis and prescribing his modern buildings as a way of preventing tuberculosis. And it's very interesting because he himself has suffered from tuberculosis. He was for a year in a sanatorium in Switzerland. His brother, who was studying medicine, died of tuberculosis. So there's also the physical and mental trauma of that generation. Immediately after streptomycin is invented, he declares his buildings to be really good for mental health, and the architect becomes a kind of shrink that has to analyze the client and understand their desires and what their prescription should be. And it's also interesting to know that he himself, Neutra, suffered from mental breakdowns repeatedly. Right? Mm. So
yeah, it's interesting that architecture plays this role as a medication, and in our exhibition, the very first piece that you see when entering the space is are these architecture pills by Hans Hollein, which I think manifest this idea and also the misunderstanding maybe in a very, very beautiful way. Mm. Yes, you basically see pills mounted on an A4 sheet, and there's a little bit of text by Hans Hollein underneath, partly saying architectural pill or environment or other partly very poetic titles. Mm-hmm. It seems as if that generation also in the 1960s was very aware of this expanded, very also medical project of architecture.
Sure. I mean, this is all in the context of a Hans Hollein project. Everything is architecture. All is architecture, right? And it's totally an expanded understanding that includes the medical, right? And the medical, of course, this pill, you know, is there is an ambiguity there. What pill is this, right? Because it could be anything. It could be anti-baby pill. It could be it could be anticonceptive. But it could there were also all these other pills that were being experimented at the time, that LSD, you know, Neutra design houses that were salons for LSD users. LSD was not forbidden at the time. It was experimented with. And it's very interesting that the context for this experimentation is modern architecture. So salons for LSD users were common in some of the clients of Neutra, for example. And then there is Kopp Himmelblau in the show too, and very few people know of his of this group early work and their research and their collaboration with the local hospital, not only on medical issues but also mental health issues, which are very, very dominant in that moment of the 60s and 70s. How does architecture contribute or can help to these medical conditions?
It seems as if after that generation, for three or four decades almost, hospitals or medical questions totally disappeared from the spectrum of architects. Mm-hmm. And it's only now that I think there's a new situation, that we see a lot of new projects by very ambitious architects that were furtherly known by museum buildings or other prestigious cultural buildings, that now they address the question of care and psychiatries, hospitals, etc. Mm-hmm. When one thinks, for instance, about the Maggie Centers, mm-hmm. Which were founded by Maggie Keswick-Jenks, the wife of Charles Jenks, it's interesting that it seems as if the role of architecture is also a bit rediscovered mm-hmm. these days. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can talk also a little bit about this, for me, really fascinating example of the Maggie Center mm-hmm. And what was done there, because it's not only an architectural project with beautiful buildings by Norm Foster, mm-hmm. Zaha Hadid, and so on, but I think the initiative taken by Maggie Keswick-Jenks and Charles Jenks is, mm-hmm. In terms of the process, I think that's also something that for us was very important to develop in the exhibition, that there's mm-hmm. not just a formal language that we're interested in, but to really understand what the topic is.
Exactly. Like the role of architecture as a therapeutic instrument, something that was totally normal in the period of the early modern architects. All architects, in the face of the devastating deaths caused by tuberculosis, I mean, 1 in 7 people in the globe were dying from tuberculosis at the beginning of the 20th century, but in big cities like Paris was more like 1 in 3. So of course that generation in these architects felt that they needed to propose solutions to this problem, to provide an architecture that was actually able to prevent, if not to cure, tuberculosis. And we thought that all of this had passed, and in a way had, you know, this clear responsibility of the architect. But with the Maggie Center, you see it coming back in a way. And it's not through the architect, but through the client. Maggie herself had suffered from cancer, and you realize the importance of the client in architecture, right? And being put in a room without windows and realizing that there is something very wrong with that situation. And then when she passed away, this foundation that was established with Charles Jenks, and the idea that these fantastic architects could provide some environment in which people could actually and do actually feel better. So a whole group of architects were asked to participate in this building, including, for example, Benedetta Tagliabue, who recently completed a fantastic Maggie Center in Barcelona, not just for women that are suffering from breast cancer, but also for children and from families that can join this kind of fantastic place where they can discuss, when they can exchange tips about this and that. Where sometimes, you know, you go to the hospital, it's right there, and there are these crazy things that you have to be at 7 o'clock for an scan, and then the doctor doesn't see you until 3 o'clock, for example. But you can go to the center and have tea and talk with other people that are experiencing the same problems and exchange tips, and your kids may be there too, playing with whatever and playing with other kids. And it humanizes all of us, right? Mm.
Shifting away a little bit from architects to medical objects, also I think from the beginning we also thought it would be very important to show some medical objects as kind of micro architectures.
Mm. Yes, for example, the famous iron lung in which kids with polio were placed in the 50s is really like a house that breathes for you, and in fact, there are still people living inside an iron lung, so it really becomes like a surrogate body, like a house. And then there's the beautiful example of this incubator, an incubator that was designed by a very young a student of design, and it's an incubator for Africa, where there are sub-Saharan Africa, where there are frequent power cuts. And apparently, you know, many kids die, thousands of babies die every year because of this, because of the power cuts and because of different conditions. They have to move the baby from one hospital to another. So he developed this fantastic and actually produced this fantastic incubator that is autonomous and can be transported easily from place to place, and is autonomous from the grid. So it's a survival equipment as well. So young designers, I was impressed by that. I discovered this piece actually in the Milano, in the Salone del Mobile, there was an exhibition of young graduates. And I realized that maybe it's because of COVID, so many of the students that were worldwide, they had produced things that have to do with medical issues. I said, you know, this is a return to another time because AIDS has put in the front of us the situation of what you call care. But care has become a very important word, right? And the need they feel as designers to contribute to caring for society resulted in a lot of prototypes and products that designs that address some health issue.
Yeah, it's also a good example for the sheer scale of what this medical situation actually implies. It's a very global situation. Very often there's a clear connection to huge problems in the global south. Mm-hmm. We have examples of contagion with malaria. Mm-hmm. For instance, this infamous example of the cordon sanitaire from the colonial Belgium and from the Congo, and where basically an African and a European city were divided by a cordon sanitaire, by a mm-hmm. kind of border that would presumably keep diseases away.
Another medical border, exactly. Physically established to separate the white population from the black population.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that the exhibition for me also covers enormously different types of scales, mm-hmm. yeah, like from say these micro architectures, the incubator, mm-hmm. to architectural projects and mm-hmm. hospitals, but then also vast territories like mm-hmm. cordon sanitaire as an urban device, mm-hmm. but also this example of the Italian peninsula, which was basically dried out in order to prevent the population from malaria. Mm-hmm. So I think the sheer scale of mm-hmm. these often very brutal politics of space mm-hmm. is to me something quite astonishing. So it's really the project of modernity mm-hmm. manifest itself very often in these projects, like in Italy, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the exhibition has in fact a huge range and a very expanded range historically, because we start with things like lazaretos, and we end up with things like COVID, right? So historically, but also, as you say, geographically, from all parts of the globe, right? And at the level of the scale, too, from the minor, from the pill to big territories, right? The smallest of it will be the pill as a form of architecture, as in Hans Holbein, as you enter the exhibition, and the big infrastructural projects, right?
Yeah, I think Beatrice, we covered most of the parameters that we were trying to develop in this exhibition. But what's probably important to mention is that an exhibition is only one format mm-hmm. of this whole project. Mm-hmm. Another one is certainly the research, which has a different life, which is online. So there's instead of a catalog, there is a whole series of online essays developed by many, many different researchers, architects, artists, scientists on efflux architecture. Maybe you can say a little bit something about this relation between exhibition making and research, because as you said, it's a research exhibition. Vice versa, almost, you could argue that that this online essay series is also a bit like an exhibition.
Really, yeah. I mean, I really very much like this idea of the exhibition as research, but also the exhibition as an archive in which the visitor is actually deeply involved. We want the exhibition. The exhibition is all about making connections, and we encourage the visitor to make these connections even with the design of the exhibition. So unlike a traditional exhibition where there are objects in the wall and it seems to be like a particular way of reading these objects, the visitor here is almost like is inside the wall making connections. So it's all about interconnections, even connections we never imagine, I'm sure, will be possible. And as you say, the exhibition exists in multiple platforms. It exists physically here in Thiba, in Brussels, but it's also on this podcast, and it's also on IFLAX. Today there was the beautiful article of Fabiola López Duran on eugenics and architecture, another unexpected issue of sickness and architecture. Who would have thought that these modern architects that we revere were so deeply involved in eugenics? And not only in Le Corbusier in Paris, but also all these Costas and all these architects in Brazil, in other places in Latin America, and how the whole program of eugenics is deeply connected to the world of architecture. That's, I think, an unexpected connection.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a fascinating exhibition, which you mentioned the design. We worked together with Office, Kirsten Gers and David van Severen, who actually helped us to push this idea of a different perception of an exhibition, which is maybe less object focused. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't treat objects like a religion or a fetish. It's mm-hmm. it's really more about trying to understand relationships.
Mm-hmm. Connections. Making connections, the connections we make, but also encouraging the viewer to make their own connections, right? So there's not a prescribed view of seeing malaria in this way, but there are a number of evidence, like in an archive, archival evidence, and also police evidence, and you are like a criminal also trying to put together the evidence and constructing a scenario of a possible understanding of the situation. One of the things that I also find interesting is the idea in one of the exhibits of Clemens Filkenstein, the idea that seismic activity could be a sign of human disease, and also, of course, disease of the planet. You know, with COVID, there was a change in seismic activity all over the world. I mean, that's incredible, right? So it expands from the scale, as you say, of the really minute thing to the scale of the planet. The planet itself is sick.
Thank you so much, Beatrice.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a SIVA podcast.